There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night, we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us right here, right now, on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast, and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
Why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo, and Cairo, and Lisbon, and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing.
Ginny Dye with us, the founder and CEO of the Ultimate Life Company, created to empower people and make a difference. She's also the owner of Together We Can Change the World, Inc. She's written 25 books, owns a publishing company, spent over 20 years in sales and marketing management. She's passionate about her mission, empowering others to become their very best while living their ultimate life. Ginny, hi, welcome to the show.
Hello, Michael. It's great to be here. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. You know, there's something called mindset, and there's so many different definitions of that. So let's lay a base, Ginny, and let's say, what is a mindset, and we'll work from there.
Mindset to me, Michael, is your attitude about life and how you approach it.
Okay, so go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, if we, you know, just cutting it straight to the core, you know, because so many people turn it into something so complicated, and it's almost like a mystery. How do you develop your mindset? And it's really nothing more than just your attitude about life and how you approach it, and what you do within your mind to get to that point.
So, in essence, it's how we think, how we feel, how we behave about what comes to us in life. Now, where's the disconnect? And there's got to be one for most people. There's got to be this overarching theme where there is a disconnect, where that mindset, their ability to deal with what life throws at them, gets thrown out and they're in a mess. Well, where usually do you find that?
I find it because people have a complete disconnect of what success really means and how people who achieve what they perceive as success have gotten there. You know, I have worked with so many people, and actually over the last 6 years, I've also written 894 stories researching and looking into the lives of people who have accomplished amazing things or are making a difference with their life. And I wrote all of these because so many people think success only comes to lucky people who just happen to be in the right place at the right time. That's the mindset that causes people to flounder all the time.
No, and let's do a reverse on that, freaking, because so many times that I have found over the years, people will people will set themselves up for failure, because for them, failure is the only way that they get recognized, and they can't make that transition or that change, and success happens to be failure to them. And it's that turnaround when they realize that they can do something better with their life and get attention in a different way.
Exactly. You know, as I work with people, I see that they either sit around waiting for success to happen to them or believe it simply never will happen. And this is a personal story, but I think it really drives home the point. You know, I've always loved to write. Well, when I was 16, my grandfather, who was a very gifted writer but never did anything with it because life got in the way in the guise of World War I, called me into his bedroom where he was dying. And he took my hand and he said, "Jenny, you have the gift I never used. Whatever you do, don't let it go to waste like I did." Well, Michael, I know he meant that to be inspirational, but the truth is it scared me to death. And all sure. I could think about was, well, whoa, what if I don't have the gift? What if I'm not good enough? And I was so afraid that I simply quit writing, except for necessary school assignments. And in my case, I was so afraid to write my first book because it was the only thing I cared so much about that I didn't think I could handle it if I tried, and I failed it. So I simply didn't try. So I couldn't fail if I didn't try, right? Well,
makes sense.
I mean, I failed simply because I refused to even try. So when I found myself in bed sick for 6 months, right before I turned 30, I wrote my first book out of sheer boredom. That was my first published book. And now I have 25 books in print and three more coming out in the next couple of months. And it's because, I was forced to alter my attitude. But whatever it is, these people who are sitting around waiting for it to happen to them, it doesn't happen if you just wait for it. And I've got story after story after story of people who chose to not sit around and wait for something to happen. They took action. And that's the secret of mindset, choosing to take action to achieve your goals.
And by the way, the other side of that, when you truly look at it, they've got to be able to believe that it is in the realm of reality. It's got to be able to be accessible to them. It's got to be a goal that they can achieve. And most people think they can't achieve the particular goals. And it's called thinking outside the box. And a great definition of that is this. Most people think thinking outside the box is something that they can't deal with. But the definition is thinking thoughts you didn't think you could think. That's where the key is, and most people are trained, and we are trained not to believe that you can do a certain thing, not to go ahead and become famous, become wealthy, become something, because if you do it, then you're doing it at someone else's expense, and that's not necessarily so. So that, I think, is something to get over when you create that mindset of it's okay for you to be a particular thing.
Well, exactly. And let me tell you what I've learned through the years as I've researched these people, that it's not talent, even though there's a lot of talented people out there. It's not, you know, a lot of different things that people think are what makes a successful person. And it's not even perseverance, even though perseverance is absolutely necessary. And I'm going to tell you a story in a minute about someone who's the most persevering guy I've ever imagined in my entire life. But what I have found is that it drills down to one thing. That these people have a mission that's bigger than what they're trying to accomplish. That's what drives people to overcome the odds and really create the goals. You know, for me, my mission is not to build an amazing company. Okay, yes, that's part of the process of building the ultimate life company. But my mission is to empower people to live a better life. My core mission, my company is in existence to create funding for nonprofit organizations. Okay, that's my mission. And that's what allows me to persevere past the challenges and the problems and all of the kind of things that pop up when you own a huge internet business. It's the mission that makes it happen. Now, I got to tell you about this guy, Michael, because I really think he's, to me, I love this guy. And I talk about him every chance I get. Never met him, but he has radically changed my life. His name is Maxie Filer, and I'm quite sure nobody's ever heard of him. Okay, well, he was married with two young sons when he decided to become an attorney. He'd been inspired by two attorneys who were making positive changes in the laws of his African-American community, and he wanted to be part of that change. Okay, that was his mission. When he got that mission, he was 36 years old. So he goes, okay, so he goes to law school, he graduated, and he took the bar exam. Well, like many others before him, he failed on the first try. It's a tough exam. So he took it again. Well, Michael, he continued to take it throughout his son's undergraduate schooling, and he continued to take it while they attended and graduated from law school.
Well, I love
and
this guy.
Yes, he continued to take it after he was working for his sons as a law clerk in their offices. Finally, after 25 years and 47 attempts, he passed the bar exam at the age of 61. While most people were retiring, he began living his dream and fulfilling his mission, which was making a difference in his community and providing law services affordable enough most people could get help. He practiced law until he was 84 years old, and the only reason he quit was because he had to take another exam, and he failed. So they took his license away. But he's still making a huge difference in his community.
You know, it's coming to me while you're telling this story and I'm listening to everything that you say, which I think is wonderful, so hear that right up front. But what you're doing is you're giving people permission. And I think that's the biggest problem that most people have. It's not okay to be successful. It's not okay to be in a good relationship. It's not okay to make money for whatever reason that they've learned. And they need somebody to say, it's okay. And if you have to be mom and hold their hand till they can see that they can do it themselves, I think that's the greatest gift that you can ever give anybody.
Well, exactly. I mean, Michael, here's the thing. I firmly believe, this is my personal belief, that every single one of us is put here with a purpose. A purpose. And people will go, well, I don't know what my purpose is. I believe they do. And I believe if they go back far enough in their life to a time when they had a burning desire, when they had a dream, when they had a, wow, wouldn't it be cool if I could? Okay, I believe people are born with a purpose and that they innately lean toward that purpose. But so many people early in life, they get knocked in the face, they get knocked on the ground, they get disillusioned, they get hurt, they get disappointed, they struggle with failure, and they go, well, I don't have a purpose. I can't do anything with my life. And so they settle for mediocrity instead of going, you know what, I do have a purpose. And I'm going to persevere through every single thing that gets thrown at me, knowing that in the process of persevering, they are achieving that purpose because they're growing and they're learning. I see that in person after person after person. The people who are successful are not overnight successes. They pay their dues. They go through pain. They go through agony. They have to struggle. They have to meet the challenges. But they've decided, this is my purpose. And I'm going to accomplish this. And people who have accomplished these things need to come alongside those who are struggling, who are just sitting there scared to death to move off of home plate. Forget first base. They haven't even left home yet. Hey, they're still stuck there, afraid that they're never going to be able to go anywhere. But every single person can. And every single person needs to know they have a purpose.
But let's talk about a word here. The word happens to be perfection. And I think there's where the problem, it's an innate problem with so many people. At my optimum best, Ginny Dye, I can only be the second best you. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to be perfect based on what you think anybody, you think perfect should be. As long as I'm trying to be someone else's perfect, I will never be my own perfect, and I will never manage or give myself permission to go out and do the best I can do on whatever my mission is. So we have to define our own sense or create our own sense of perfection. If you go to the dictionary defines perfection as the perfection is your highest sense of, oh, I lost the word I want. It's your, I'll call you at 4 o'clock in the morning when I remember the word. But
that's actually a good time to call me.
But perfection is your highest sense of being, let's call it that. And it's your being, not somebody else's. Highest form of function, that's what I wanted. Perfection is the highest form of function. And if you're in the pits, and that's where you're functioning at that moment, it's absolutely perfect for you. So as long as we don't gauge ourselves based on what we think somebody should think we are like, then the mission happens, and then all of the things that you're saying comes together, because now you can feel yourself, you can look in the mirror and smile, and you can move forward.
Exactly. You know, when I created the Ultimate Life Company, I did it because as I look around, I see that most people, because of what they have had ingrained in them, most people view success as wealth or fame. Okay, well, let's just hit this straight up and right on.
Sure.
Not everyone can be wealthy, and not everybody can be famous. Because if everybody was famous, they would have no people who thought they were famous. Okay, not everybody is going to become that. And the truth of the matter is that success is not about great wealth and great fame. Success is about living a great life. I know people who collect garbage that live a great life, Michael, because yep. They're happy, they have great relationships, they're in great health, they do their job with all the passion that they can and choose to live joyfully in the midst of that. And then I know people who have tremendous wealth that are some of the most miserable people I've ever seen. But we have programmed people almost to go, well, I'm not successful if I'm not like that person. No, you're absolutely right. Success is when you become your best you. And everybody has to fulfill their purpose. There have to be teachers. There have to be people who clerk at the grocery stores. It takes an awful lot of people to make this world go round.
Oh, absolutely.
And every single one of them are important and valued and have an amazing purpose if they can get to the point where they're like, wow, I just have to be the best me that I can be. And that's where you find that happiness and contentment, not struggling and trying to be somebody else's definition of that.
And what you're dealing with here also is mindset. Mindset is what you think, the way you think, how you think. You said that up front. But your life is how you think it to be. And if you think it to be mediocre, well, guess what you're going to find? You're going to find it to be mediocre. And right. I think one of the most powerful things anybody can hear is this, that that we talk about knowledge is power. Knowledge is not power. It's the application of the knowledge where the real power comes from. And your life is just having a life and thinking about your life means nothing unless you put something behind it, unless you put some activity behind it and create all those things that you think of. And if you think it, you can make it happen.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Take the first step. And I think that's really what you're dealing with here. And there are so many people who won't take the first step. And you said it early on when you talked, they're celebrities that are making just billions, tens of millions of dollars that are very unhappy. Look at the Britney Spears and the rest of them. Exactly. I'll give you Charlie Sheen if you want.
But when it comes, we better not go there, Michael.
Okay. But the point here is this, is that you've got these people with everything that you could ever want, and then when they get there, they cannot deal with it.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, the thing that I have found is that the people who have to struggle for it tend to deal with it a lot more.
Yeah.
You know, like Charlie, he was born into it. Okay. And
sure.
So, I mean, the man's got a lot of problems. He's got a lot of issues. And I actually feel more sorry for him than anything else. And
absolutely.
And it, you know, I want to shake people and say, why are you spending your time following this craziness?
Yeah.
Live your life. Live your life and create something amazing.
No, absolutely. And you said it early on also, which I completely agree with you. I'll say it in a different way. I'll paraphrase it. You don't have to be the wealthiest person in the world. You don't have to be the most famous person in the world. If you're a mom, if you're a homemaker, or if you're a dad, a stay-at-home dad, whatever the case may be, if you're happy doing what you do, and home is where it's at for you, then that's where you stay. That's the best that you want. And at least when you go to bed at night, you can smile. And when you get up in the morning, you're smiling when you get up and you're ready to face the day. When you realize that you get into what you want, and sometimes what you've got, you may not like, but your mindset caused you to want it. It's not what you need. It's what you want. And
right.
when you make that transition from need to want, all of a sudden life is different.
Exactly. Exactly. There's so many people living such great lives, and they don't know they're living great lives. They think they're not, but they're really living great lives. And people that they think are living these great lives would change with them in a heartbeat.
Hey, by the way, I could tell you a great story. Tacos. Tacos was the tacos changed my life. Even the guy in the computer said, tacos. Tacos changed my life. 2002. Now, by the way, this is very personal, so you got to promise me you won't tell anybody.
Nobody other than all the people listening, I promise.
No, okay, just us. All right, 2002, I get divorced, and she's a wonderful woman. We still talk. Now, I get divorced, and I was in the house, and there was all the ghosts in the house. They were still there. I could still hear her coming up the stairs. So the hardest thing for me to get used to was living alone after 18 years. So I'm sitting there one night, and I got my two dogs and two cats, and I started to make tacos. I loaded that kitchen table up with a feast like you wouldn't absolutely believe that you could have. It was just me. And I sat down and I started to eat, and I got that epiphany, that moment of understanding, aha. And when I got it was I was enjoying myself by myself, having a dinner that was fit for 12 people, and it was okay. At that moment, I didn't need anybody to be with to sit down and enjoy dinner. Now, that doesn't mean I don't want to be with anybody, but what I transitioned to, if I wanted to go to the show by myself, if I wanted to go out to dinner by myself, I would. I didn't need anybody to be with me. I wanted to do things, and that's where the transition comes. When we stop needing and get into wanting, we're okay.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Tacos did it for me.
Boy, I can just echo that so much because I see it apply in my own life all the time. I was dealing with some stuff with my business a couple of weeks ago, and I had been writing in my journal, well, I need this, and I need this, and I need this. And then we actually had one of our speakers come on, Mary Morrissey, who's she's just an amazing woman. And as I was listening to her talk, I was like, okay, I'm doing this wrong. I need to change my language. So I started writing the next morning in my journal, I want this. I want this to happen. I want this to happen. And I took it completely out of any kind of a need-based thing. And it was so wild, Michael, because within 48 hours, everything that I had been thinking I needed so bad, once I changed it to I want this, and I took the need out, I had everything that I wanted within 48 hours.
And that's the key. That's absolutely
key.
Now,
yeah,
we're starting
to run
out.
That's mindset. That's changing how you view something
mindset.
And changing your attitude about
she
life.
She called me 4 days later, and I said, I don't need you. Give me a taco.
That's great.
Jenny Dye, let me ask you this. Do you have a website we can find you at?
I do. And, in fact, I have a gift for your listeners tonight as well. If they go to ultimatelifegift.com, they can get a free copy of my book, If You Want to Be a Success, Learn from 100-plus people who already are. And the stories that I shared today are just a few within this amazing book, and all of them get it for free. And then they can also get a free VIP guest pass to an event of their choice within the Ultimate Life Company. It's just my gift to them. We've got some amazing speakers coming up who are giving away hundreds of dollars of free bonuses. UltimateLifeGift.com, and they can take whatever they want.
Love every second of it. Jenny Dye, you're delightful, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Michael. Have a great night.
Good night.
Why could Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. So many simply incredible places to see.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Pick up a phone, call us, join in, 530-413-4511 or 530-413-4515. Join us anytime. Join our guests.
Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice. Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous.
Matt Whitfield with us, features editor, Yahoo Entertainment, and is the features editor for Yahoo Entertainment sites. Matt covers stories and news for Yahoo TV, Yahoo Movies, OMG, oh my God, and Yahoo Music. And we're going to talk about, well, one of Radio Suzy's most favorite things, and we're talking dance. Hey, Suze, you with us?
I'm here.
Hey, Matt, you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me back.
Oh, wonderful, and thank you so much for being here. Matt, the last Dancing with the Stars, what did you see? Susie's over there falling off her chair. When what's-her-name, I'll never forget, what's-her-name got let go, who was that?
Oh, Wendy?
When Wendy got let go, I think she should have got let go the first night.
Well, Wendy was lucky to survive week one, and the fact that she made it to week two was pretty much, you know, as far as she was going to get. So it was definitely no surprise last night to see her go.
There was no suspense.
No suspense at all. And the funny thing is, you know, this season has come back, and everybody was interested because of the train wreck cast that was there, and everyone was, you know, wondering how Kirstie Alley would perform. But last night's ratings were down significantly, and I'm not saying that the show is out of steam by any means, but I think a lot of people were just completely bored. Everybody knew it was Wendy's time to go.
I agree. Yeah, yes, it was. There wasn't any other, I think, that really stood out, period. And I think that that was probably the case before she danced on Monday.
Exactly. I mean, everybody knows that at this point, the favorites to make it to the end are Hines Ward, Ralph Macchio, and Kirstie Alley. And, you know, for the next few weeks, we're probably just going to see a few of the people at the bottom of the pack peel off one by one. It was obviously Wendy's week to go. Next week, I think that Sugar Ray and Chris Jericho are both kind of in danger. And, you know, the next few weeks might be a little bit of a snore, but, you know, hopefully with the Pasodoble and the waltz up next week, we'll have something to entertain us.
Matt, let me tell you what I saw that they did that I thought was absolutely phenomenal. Each week, they took a different theme. You know, there was a part where, you know, the worst thing that ever happened to you, the thing that stayed with you, that caused you to change your life. And the second one was love, basically. And I watched Macchio, and I watched a few of them go through it. And those that really got it, the dancing was almost secondary to the emotion that they were showing. And that's what I think captured the entire audience. Now, whether the ratings were up, down, indifferent, what they did, and they should have been doing this years back when they started this thing, what they did was they actually created what dancing should be about. They were not dancing. They were part of the music. They were part of the feeling. And it was all collectively one movement going forward, and they became what they were doing.
It was like they were telling their own story.
And this is a very interesting show. Again, this is not like American Idol where it's just about people picking up the phone to vote. It's a combination of the judges' score and people picking up the phone to vote. So, you know, having a great song and a great costume and conveying a lot of emotion plays such a vital role in a show like Dancing with the Stars, where it's not just about the way your feet are moving.
Well, that's the whole thing. Once that emotion becomes a part of you, the footwork is very secondary, and that's what makes it so special. And this is a very, very difficult thing to do. It really is.
Look, I don't want to take anything away from Jennifer Grey. I was rooting for her last season, and she was a flawless dancer at 50 years old. I mean, she impressed everybody. But the main, you know, aspect of her taking that trophy by the end of the season was the whole, you know, coming back from being a star of the 80s and her relationship with Patrick Swayze, who had recently passed away. Everybody got caught up in the swell of that emotion, and I think that's what carried her to the win. I mean, her moves were also great, but that emotion associated with Patrick Swayze is really why she won.
Matt, what they caught was, which they hadn't been catching, was what happened with Jennifer Grey and what started to happen during this last one. I didn't watch the whole thing. I got bits and pieces. But they involved the audience. You were living what was going on in what they were depicting. That's what captures an audience. If I'm seeing myself as part of that, not necessarily the dancing, but the love affair, that sometime, somewhere, somehow, something that happened that was part of my own life that I resonate to in some form, something familiar that I see, that's what captures an audience, and that's what makes popularity. If I can live what I'm seeing, then you got me.
Well, I was kind of surprised that the WWE wrestler Chris Jericho, who had a really touching performance this week, it was dedicated to his mother who passed away a little while ago. And I just thought that he was, you know, fantastic this week. And he definitely was not at the top of the judges' pack. And a lot of people didn't seem to pick up the phones to vote for him. So I don't know if that has to do with the fact that he's not as big of a star as somebody as Ralph Macchio or Kirstie Alley. But, you know, I connected to his dance, and I thought it was very emotional and very powerful this week. But a lot of people aren't picking up the phone for him, and I think that he's in danger next week.
You know, what I found very interesting was they picked the rumba. The rumba is a very sexy, passionate dance. And I just found that interesting, you know, because he was relating to his mom. I don't know.
Right. That probably didn't have the greatest connection there. But, you know, at the same time, I thought that the music choice was great. They performed to the Beatles' Let It Be, and it really worked for me. But again, next week the theme is Classical Week, and the couples are going to be performing either the Pasodoble or the Waltz. So, you know, I love those dances. I find them very technical. You know, they also put some people to sleep. So next week might be a slow week. I'm still looking forward to it, however.
I got a question, because I thought this was interesting. When Dancing with the Stars on, when Radio Suzy comes in and she does the show, she produces, she does all the wonderful things that she does, if it extends later on, she's here and she watches it and she finishes it, which I think is a good thing. Now, she and I talked about something, and I want to say this as respectfully as I can. When Kirstie Alley was on that first time, she was looking good. I mean, her legs looked good. I mean, she looked good. Did it look like to you she gained weight?
Well, everybody this entire season is kind of based around Kirstie and her weight battle. I mean, she's actually talking about it, and I appreciate the fact that she's willing to continue to discuss that, you know, in such a public forum in front of so many millions of viewers. But, you know, last season a lot of people thought last season that Bristol Palin was packing on the pounds. Yeah. You know, she's performing, and in theory you'd be losing a lot of weight because of all of the practice. But, you know, the stress of being on reality TV, you know, might lead you to a bag of Doritos by the end of the night.
You know, the other thing about Kirstie Alley, it all depends also what you're wearing. And her dress showed more of her leg, maybe because Max fell and that was more apparent. But I think that also has something to do with it.
Look, I have to be honest. I mean, Max fell this week, and I think that he is the one that should be to blame for her score. I mean, her scores were still decent. They got a 21 this week, but Max's fall was definitely the reason that those sevens were sevens and not eights or even nines. I think that she still looked great this week. I think that she's still truly impressing people. I mean, I think people thought that she was going to be an utter train wreck. So I definitely expect to see them at the top of the pack next week. They're, you know, going to go out there and knock out a waltz, and I think they'll look great as long as Max's legs don't give out.
I like Wendy. Wendy said she was done. They got rid of her. She walked off like, I got better things to do. Let me out of here.
Yeah, she left Tony. She just left him. Unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, she also kind of hinted at the fact that she was more busy than the other contestants because she had to fly back and forth to do her radio show in New York and then train out in Los Angeles. And, you know, part of me was like, okay, I get that. She's spending a lot of time in the air. But at the same time, I'm like, you're Wendy Williams. You're not the biggest star of this cast, so don't act like you are, because, you know, I don't see a Super Bowl trophy on your mantle. I don't see, you know, an Emmy the way Kirstie Alley has. You didn't star in a movie like The Karate Kid. So, you know, take your attitude and go. You had a decent run, but you never were in the running to win this.
I like the football player.
Yeah, Hines Ward. I mean, he's averaging 23 points per dance. So he's at the top of the pack right now. We've said this before. I'll say it again. Professional athletes typically do extremely well. They are often the winners of these seasons. So I definitely expect to see Hines in the final four, you know, alongside Ralph Macchio and Kirstie Alley. So the next few weeks is just about getting rid of the riffraff, and then we'll get really into the swing of things.
I agree. I want to say one other thing about Max and Kirstie. It's so difficult to pick up, you know, the show must go on when there's some disaster. And when it's reality TV, I mean, I thought she was awesome.
Yeah, I don't think that she's getting enough credit. I mean, he's the one who fell over, and then the fact that she was still able to, you know, perform the rest of that dance with him. I mean, they still looked great out there, and the movement was there, and they didn't really lose that much focus. And she ought to be commended for that, because most people would have just, you know, fallen apart completely.
Oh, you're mortified. I mean, it happened to me, so I can tell you. And oh, my gosh, you know, when my heel caught in my dress. And I couldn't get
it
off.
You know, I think that because of their slip up this week, they're going to come back with, you know, guns blazing next week. And I definitely think, you know, Max is uber competitive. He wants to win. And I think that Kirstie, after that, getting over that hurdle of the first week and realizing that America really loves her story and is really behind her, I think that they want to go all the way. And I think that they're just really going to bring it next week.
I want to say one other thing about Max, too. I mean, I really commend him, because he was very uncomfortable, you know, at the talk shows later that night. They're all making this, you know, and he really didn't want to talk about it. He said, it's not about me. But that was the news.
Well, it was really unfortunate, because a lot of people were like, oh, did his leg give out because of Kirstie's weight? And I just think that that's really awful. And a lot of people, including George Lopez, have been picking on her because of her weight. Look, the woman is 60 years old. She looks great. She's out there dancing and busting, you know, major hours in the dance studio. So she really deserves some credit here. And his leg gave out because he had a cramp. His leg didn't give out because of Kirstie. They got back up. They looked great. And I'm looking forward to seeing them next week.
And what do you think about Chelsea? I think she's adorable.
You know, Chelsea's hit or she's hit or miss for me. She, you know, was great coming out of the gate that first week, and then the second dance really didn't work. Week 3, she looked a lot better with the cha-cha-cha. I just don't know if she, you know, is connecting with the audience the way I want her to. She's
I think
young,
she's going to come around.
But you know who you see in her? You know who you see in her?
Who do I see?
And everybody does, I think. Goldie Hawn.
Yes.
If you listen to her and she'll do the, I'm not too brainy, whatever, and the laugh and the rest of it, it's very subtle. But that's what everybody loves about her. There's Goldie Hawn that they're looking at.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, we're not looking at Goldie Hawn. I'd rather watch her out there. But I definitely see the resemblance there with Chelsea. I just think that, you know, she has a lot of younger voters and viewers rooting for her right now. I think that we need to see her mature over the course of the next few weeks and put, you know, her Disney gimmick aside and really mature to see if she can lure in some more of those older voters.
Let me throw something out about the athletes, and I think this is interesting. When I was in high school, 376.4 years ago, when I was in high school, I ran track and I played football. And in addition to that, I have been a bodybuilder all my life. I'm no Schwarzenegger, but I stay there. Now, that said, if you take a boxer, you can see the rhythm in them. And you take all these other athletes, you can see the rhythm. You get a football player in there, I mean, that's just mad crash, get him and knock him down. So we give this guy 10 times the credit, and one of the reasons for that is these are not sensitive guys. And what he did, I think he stepped outside of himself and did a job that wouldn't quit. So, and when you're dealing with somebody like me thinking about it, you got to realize that if I was had my choice, John Wayne and the Fonz would be president and vice president of the United States. So that's where that mindset comes from.
Well, the funny thing here is Hines Ward is a football player, and he is so more elegant and light on his toes than Sugar Ray Leonard, the boxer. I mean, Sugar Ray is in serious danger, and he will probably be going home in the next week or two, and he should go home because he really is not that impressive out there, whereas a big brute, you know, a big, strong football player like Hines Ward is just amazing. I mean, he is really blowing people away. And so,
go home.
Oh, Sugar Ray?
Yeah, we want to be the guy to tell him to go home.
Well, you know, I don't think he's fast enough. I mean, he probably still has a great punch, but, you know, if you can't catch up to somebody, there's no point in that. I mean, he's slow out there. His feet are lazy.
Yeah, his time is coming. I think it's next week. And, you know, going back to Hines for a minute. Pardon?
I think Sugar Ray is doomed in the next week or two, without a doubt.
Yeah, I do, too. And the other thing about Hines is he's so likable. He just
has
this
smile. I mean, a lot of people didn't know who he was. Everybody knew that he played for the Steelers, but nobody knew if he was going to bring any personality to the dance floor.
Yes.
And that was my major concern with him leading into this season. But in addition to being great out on that dance floor, he's so incredibly likable. And he has a whole new generation of fans now that didn't even know his football career. And I think that he's definitely going to go far because, you know, he has a great smile, and his feet also happen to be doing the right thing out there.
Yes.
Oh, okay. It's time to go. Matt Whitfield, can we get a website we can find you at?
You can find me across all of Yahoo's entertainment sites and on Twitter at Life on the M List.
Wonderful. Hey, thanks for being here. We'll see you next week.
Thanks, guys.
Take care. Good night.
Bye-bye.
I can only give you love that lasts forever and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all.
You can pick up a phone and join us anytime, 530-413-4511 or 530-413-4515.
for a tour. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Alan Smith with us, Dr. Alan Smith. He's the author of The Looting of Social Security. He's developed much of his adult life into battling economic illiteracy and promoting economic education. He's taught economics to college students for over 30 years now before retiring as professor of economics at Eastern Illinois University in 1998 to become a full-time writer. Alan, hi. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we deal with economic literacy, most people have no idea that what that term means, let alone know what's behind all of that. We live in a world now that basically we're told what to think, how to think, because of the media and because of political messages. It's very confusing. Alan, how do you cut through all the red tape and get right down to truly what it is that we're dealing with when we're dealing with our economy?
Well, it's difficult.
Not an easy question.
It's difficult because people are totally, mostly illiterate, and most members of Congress are economically illiterate. But in terms of the actual Social Security, that is a very clear-cut thing. All has to do with something took place in 1983, and most people don't even know that something significant took place in 1983. And
which
was that
what?
Was the, pardon?
I would say which was what?
Okay, that was the so-called fix of Social Security. You had the Greenspan Commission in 1982 looking at the future and the baby boomer and say, look, we got problems. These baby boomers come along, there won't be enough to pay their benefits. We've got to do something, and what they decided to do is pre-tax or make the baby boomers prepay the cost of their benefits. They had a hefty payroll tax increase enacted in 1983, and the baby boomers have paid enough. There's supposed to be $2.6 trillion in the Social Security Trust Fund, which would pay until the oldest of baby boomers are 91 years old, up through 2037. The only problem is the government has spent all that money.
Now, didn't that happen during the Clinton era? You know, it was supposed to be the Clinton era. We were supposed to be one of the greatest times that we had economically because our debt, our national debt, was down. And I think what happened was they dipped into the Social Security lockbox, quote unquote, put it into the general fund, and ended up paying bills with it, and then there was nothing to replace it.
Well, it started when the money first came in 1985, and it's been going on under five presidents since that day. Let me just, if I can here,
please.
I just pulled this up. When Ronald Reagan signed this, 1983, Tip O'Neill and Reagan, it was supposed to be a big compromise. Republicans, Democrats went together. And when he signed this bill, this is what he told the American people. Our elderly need no longer fear that the checks they depend on will be stopped or reduced. These amendments protect them. Americans of middle age need no longer worry whether their career-long investments will pay off. These amendments guarantee it. And younger people can feel confident that Social Security will still be around when they need it cushioned for retirement. These amendments reaffirm the commitment of our government to the performance and stability of Social Security. Now, that's what the President of the United States said publicly at the time that he was signing this bill. The bill was the Social Security Amendments of 1983. And most people don't seem to know that tax has generated $2.6 trillion in excess revenue that was supposed to be saved and invested. And every penny of that is gone. It's a matter of debate as to whether you say it was borrowed or stolen.
Sure.
I say it was stolen because no provisions have been made to repay it.
know, by the way, the biggest problem, I think one of the biggest myths that we run into, Alan, is that that Social Security in and of itself, that we, when we're supposed to get it, that we have a legal right to those Social Security benefits, and it's not true. And if we think we pay Social Security taxes into the system, well, we've got some kind of a legal guarantee that the systems will benefit us, they'll pay us back, and it's not so. Because
that is true from a standpoint of a Supreme Court decision ruling a long time ago, and they ruled that nobody has this legal right. But from a moral standpoint, government has always operated and told the people, you pay your Social Security taxes, you get your benefits. So it was never a public understanding that you didn't have a right to it. But you are right that there's I can't think of the cases, Nestor versus somebody.
I think it was Helvin and Davis, Fleming and Nestor. I think those two cases were very important cases.
And, So you're right. And what this means is that Congress could go into session, decide to end Social Security, repeal it, discontinue it. President could sign it, and there's nothing illegal or unconstitutional about it.
That's what the U.S. Supreme Court ruled when they did, that Social Security taxes are simply taxes, and they convey no, and this is the critical part, no property or contractual rights to Social Security benefit. It is not our property. And Social Security is entirely dependent upon the political decisions of the president and the Congress. Most people don't get that.
That's true. And most people don't get what's been going on for the last 25 years. That money coming in, not $1 of that $2.6 trillion went for Social Security in any way. This all went to replace the tax cuts. We had initially the Reagan tax cuts in 81 and the first 3 years after that, and then later the George W. Bush tax cuts. Every dollar of the $2.6 trillion that was generated from this payroll tax increase has just simply gone into the general fund and replaced those other dollars. It has not in any way been used for Social Security.
No, not at all. And I think really when we take a look at taxes, and everybody screams and yells about taxes, and it still stands that the wealthiest 10% of earners pay more than just billions of dollars, roughly two-thirds of all income taxes. And if you break it down, those that the poorest third of the wage earners basically pay no income tax at all. So when we look at the things that we're told as opposed to the reality of what is, there's got to be a tremendous amount of confusion in most people.
Yeah, well, I think, Michael, you just added to it a little bit right there. You're right. Everything you said was correct. But there has been, over the last 30 years, a increasing burden on the lower and middle income classes and a decreasing burden on the upper class. The percentage of their income actually paid in taxes as a high income is less than it was in 1981. And when you say a lot of the poor don't pay any income taxes, they're the ones who, if they're working at all, they pay the payroll tax. And that payroll tax has been used as general revenue, the same as income tax. So there has been, we probably have different philosophies here, but there has definitely been a movement, a redistribution of income and wealth over the last 25, 30 years.
Oh, no question. Alan, I think one of the biggest problems that we have, I'll bring a word up. We're talking about reform, and reform's overdue, but the problem with reform, what people call reform, is nothing more than a Band-Aid to make things more palatable, and we end up back where we started. So it never seems to do anything to itself, and it doesn't matter what administration's in there, whether it's Republican, whether it's Democrat, whatever the case may be, it always seems to move back to the same thing. And you said it, five different presidents, it's all the same thing. Nobody fixed it. They talked, but that's where it stopped.
That's absolutely true, and we had one senator openly admit it on March 16th, I believe it was. Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma stood on the Senate floor, and he said, under Republicans and Democrats, this money has been stolen. It's gone. It's the $2.63 trillion does not exist. It was spent for other things, and that's the fact. That's what I have been for 10 years trying to get this point out, And I have had all kinds of opposition, especially lack of cooperation from the news media, who do not report this program because the government doesn't want it reported.
No, no, not at all. Well, they'd run out of money. And I think that the cure-all for all of this is privatization. You know, on a practical level, you look at what privatization means to the average person on the street. Personal retirement accounts, the IRAs, the 401ks. You see, and if there would be a regulatory structure, an oversight, some kind of rules custodians have to follow, I think it would be safe. And that's where I think we could come out ahead. But privatization and the free market ideas are simply, they're waning away. We're starting to lose sight of that, and it seems that they're almost beyond grasp at this point.
Well, Michael, the views on that, there are people who wish our system was a private one and versus the one we have. But there has been a lot of misleading of people. Hey, this system doesn't work. It just is never. I've heard of the statement that is used so much. Social Security, as currently exists, is unsustainable in the long term. Well, it has been sustainable for 75 years. And right now, and I want to make this point emphatically clear, right now, today, if the government had kept their fingers out of that money, if that money had been left alone, there would be no Social Security problem whatsoever until 2037. That is 26 years away. And by simply removing the cap on the Social Security payroll tax, you would be able to make it solvent indefinitely. So it's a matter of political preference as to whether you want it private or you want it public. The problem is not Social Security. It doesn't work. It has worked, and it's worked well. The problem is the government can't keep its hands off the Social Security money.
I think that's absolutely the key. And the FICA taxes, the payroll taxes, they'll never be sufficient to cover what the Social Security is. And also, the FICA taxes, and I'll just touch on one other thing, and then we'll move back to point. The FICA taxes in and of themselves are one of the things that caused us not to be competitive in the global marketplace, because the other countries that were competing for the different manufacturing jobs and so on and so forth, they didn't have to pay payroll taxes, and we got stuck with that. And part of that competitive pricing that we had to look at was what we had to pay in payroll taxes, which threw us out of the game totally.
Yeah, the FICA tax, you know, if they had in 1983 just eliminated the FICA tax and replaced it all with the income, they had the same amount of tax, but it all comes in as a regular income tax, everything would be the same. I mean, they say we got to keep Social Security separate. You got to pay your own tax for that. Well, that's fine, except the government used that money exactly the way they would have if it had been income taxes. So we never needed the FICA tax.
Yeah, no question about it. And I really think when we really come down to it, that the system in and of itself, and when I say the system is corrupt, that doesn't mean somebody's stealing something. Corrupt just means broken. There's a disconnect within the system, and that's why we're having the problems that we're having.
But somebody is stealing something, Michael. This is the thing.
I'm trying to be good about this, but it's true. Look at all the hundreds of millions and billions of dollars that we can't account for right now. Where does it go? They just picked up $350 million on Medicare because of prescriptions that were paid for that they could have got them for probably a fraction of that if they wouldn't have bought the name brand, et cetera. I mean, this is constant. There's that kind of money going out totally. Where does it go to? And if we say we're stealing it, where does that money go?
Well, the government is literally stealing. I mean, the FICA tax is a dedicated tax to be used exclusively for Social Security. That money, the intent of that 1983 legislation was that all of that money would be saved and invested in marketable public issue treasury bonds bought in the open market. This means the money would have gone to Bill Gates and people who are selling those. There would have been no money for the government to spend on other things. We would have those marketable treasury bonds in the trust fund right now, and everything would be great. The fact is that the government spent all that money, then they put IOUs in there and tried to claim that the money was invested in those IOUs. And I've been fully involved for 10 years of researching and writing about Social Security. I've written 4 books on it, and I've just been so angry the whole time that we can't get this message out. Our government literally ripped off the American people.
And it would be fine if we could point it at one administration, but we can't point it at an administration.
No, it's Republican and Democrat. And yeah. Let me just give an example of somebody you might, I'm sure with your philosophy, you'd like to target, so I'll help you do it, and that is Senator Harry Reid. Harry Reid, in a speech 21 years ago in the Senate floor, some congressional record, says we're embezzling the Social Security money, we have been stealing from the recipients, and a whole bunch of other things along those lines, and nothing has changed, and today he's saying it's fully funded for the next 40 years. He abandoned his fight to do something about it back along with all the others involved in this misappropriation or theft.
No, by the way, Alan, I am right to center. I mean, there's no question about that. I'll tell everybody that. But I'm not radical. There are things on the left that I happen to believe to be so, and there are certain things that we would do a combination. We would move forward together in the right place. Reid and Pelosi are put in the same category, and I would give you one thing with Pelosi, and enough said with it, is that what she said, go ahead and pass it, and you'll find out what's in it after we do it. That in and of itself said something. What it said was that we don't have the brains, we don't have the common sense to be able to deal with what they're doing, so they're going to do what they want to do because we're not smart enough to be able to help make a decision. You still there?
Okay. I'm still here. I'm just listening because I agree totally. I mean, you're not going to find me defending any elected politician today. I can't think of anyone on either party that I want to defend.
Well, that's how the Electoral College got started. If you go all the way back to the Founding Fathers, you had farmers out there. You had people who couldn't read, who couldn't write, who really couldn't help in making a decision about how this country should be run. In those days, I could understand it, so they created the Electoral College, and they had, you know, the representatives based on the volume of people in the state able to vote for president. We still have it today. Good, bad, or indifferent, that's what we had. But we have a very sophisticated constituency today. We have something called the Internet where you can hit Google and find out anything you want at any time you want it. They're not dealing with farmers anymore, and they're not acting like it.
That makes a big difference.
Yeah, and I think your word should get out there, and I truly, really believe that. Well, the Great American Frontier. Yeah, we had that. Parents taught their kids the skills that they needed to learn how to survive. And little by little over the years, the government took those skills over. The kids are not depending upon their parents anymore. They're depending upon government and the state, you know, assuming the functions that were once left to the parent. That's what's happened in the last 100 years or so, and we are the result and effect of it.
Well, one thing that makes this somewhat of a unique scandal, and I do believe it is a scandal which will eventually come out and become a national scandal that will make Watergate pale in comparison, is Watergate was one of those things where one political party would benefit by exposing the other political party. This is one where the Republicans and Democrats are both equally guilty. If this ever comes out, it'll ruin the careers, political careers of an awful lot of people who've been doing this stuff for all these years. And therefore, the Republicans and Democrats alike are trying to keep this down. And the media, the mainstream media, does not report this. And I've had, way back in 1990, I had an op-ed published in the Denver Post about Senator Moynihan and his fight on Social Security. I could get an op-ed in the Denver Post on that this time. I can't get hardly any paper to carry anything that tells the truth here, what I call the great Social Security theft.
And I got it loud and clear. Alan, I could talk to you all night, but we're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, I do. It is www.thebiglie.net.
I love every second of that one. Alan Smith, Dr. Alan Smith, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time. Get that word out there.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
Okay, good night.
Good night.
Turley White, Just a jackknife, a hazel to make a heath, babe. And he keeps it out of sight. You know when that shark bites with his teeth, baby, scarlet below stop to spread. But fancy gloves, though, wears old Maggaheath, baby. So there's never a trace of red. I let them things swing on a sidewalk. Sunday morning, lies a body just oozing life. Beep! And someone sneaking round the corner. Tell me, could that someone be Mac the Knife?
I'm Michael Ray Dresser. Stay up, stay tuned, stay with us. There's so much more to come. Wait till you hear what's coming next. Get some backbone here.
Oh, that cement is there, strictly for the weight, dear. Five will get you 10 old Mackies back in town. Hey, hey, about Louis Miller, he done disappeared, dear. After drawing out, feels good, all his hard-earned cash. And now Mackie spends just like a shiner. Could it be our boy's done something rash? Come on. Then he died a
Pick up a phone and call us, 530-413-4511 or 530-413-4515. Susan Marshall back with us, author, speaker, and president of Executive Advisor LLC, independent consulting firm founded in 1997, specializes in leadership, development, and executive effectiveness. She is the author of How to Grow a Backbone, 10 Strategies for Gaining Power and Influence at Work. And Susan Marshall, hi, welcome back.
Hi, Michael Ray.
How are you?
It's a wonderful, wonderful evening. You know, I'm terrific, and I was very keen to hear the caller, or I'm sorry, the man that you were just talking to.
Yeah.
Interesting. I just heard the last, you know, minute of it, but wow. Yeah. Powerful stuff.
No, when we get into it. And by the way, the one thing that the government hasn't had, watch this segue. You're going to love this.
I love it.
Okay.
Here it comes.
The one thing that the government hasn't had is discipline.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, yes. You know what? And discipline is just a dirty old word to a
Absolutely.
Lot of people. And more all the time. You know, for wherever this notion was born, that I can do what I feel like doing, when I feel like doing it, and just skip doing the stuff I don't want to do, and still be just fine, and actually probably be highly successful. People are going to pay me a lot of money. Where did that come from? Where in heaven's name did that come from? But it's everywhere. And we're seeing it now in the political arena. It's fascinating to me, and you know the work that I do, to watch what's happening in the political arena, not only here in Wisconsin, which has been, you know, national news, but nationally and even internationally, the bad behaviors and the utter lack of discipline. I find myself shaking my head almost
Unbelievable.
Every day. Unbelievable.
If you disagree with me, I'm going to have somebody stand in front of your shop and say, don't participate here. If you disagree with me, I'm going to see about getting you, recalling you. We don't care if we've been asking for a leader, somebody to stand up for what they believe in. But if you do that, we're going to get rid of you. This is insanity.
It is. And what's so perverse about what you just said is that the notion of leadership, this notion of discipline, has been so distorted. And now bad bullying behaviors, right, which we're trying to eradicate from schools, we're now watching adults model perfectly. And they will say we're being disciplined. It's a disciplined approach. It's a disciplined approach to taking out our adversaries. No,
Susan, I don't see any difference. I don't see any difference between if you watch the news, if you watch the major news, if you watch the news and you see people in the Middle East, they're demonstrating, then they're chanting, whatever they're chanting, they're demonstrating. And then you start to watch what's going on here in Madison, Wisconsin, in New York, in Ohio, in some of the states. It's the same sound and the same look. We may dress differently. We may say words differently, but it is the same thing. It is spreading throughout the world. There's no discipline.
Well, there is no discipline, and that's the thing that really gets to be a frightening prospect. When we work with people, and I'll confess, you know what, we all have our issues, right? And discipline, we like the word. Well, let me say this differently. We like the idea of it when we think we can do it, but when it's going to get too hard, then, you know, we get busy doing other stuff.
Yeah.
And I have a discipline issue myself. I hate the snooze button. It's not my friend. And as you know, I'm just leaning into writing a new series of backbone guides. And it's hard work, and it's very, very difficult to stay disciplined when the alarm goes off at 5:30 and I think, okay, I've got to sit there and I've got to snooze, hit the snooze, hit the snooze.
Yeah.
When I finally do get up, I think, well, you know what, you slug. I'm mad at myself for at least a good part of the morning, which is totally unproductive. Versus I say, okay, and we make the decision the night before, right, when we set the alarm, what time have I decided to get up? And then when we have to remake that decision every time we hit the snooze button, we not only get mad at ourselves, but we waste incredible amounts of energy. So if I get up, when the alarm goes off, I feel better, I feel proud of myself, I feel like I've accomplished something. Now, that may sound really silly, but anybody who's ever been on a diet knows exactly the feeling. Anybody who's tried to quit smoking, anybody who's tried to stop being a couch potato, we think our way to a better place, but we actually have to discipline ourselves to do it.
Okay, let me tell you my fix to that wake-up problem.
Mm-hmm.
There's a really great fix. The night before, I call Radio Susie and I say, would you call me at 9 o'clock in the morning? And she calls. And if I'm not up, she calls again. And if I'm not up, she calls again. Now, I hate her.
Yeah.
But then I can blame her for the whole thing.
Yeah, right. That's funny.
Okay, it was a good try.
You know, that's a good strategy. But the point here is, you know what, when we haven't made a decision, then we continue to negotiate with ourselves. And I spend a lot of time actually working with young professionals on time management. And you can imagine all of the technology tools they use and all of the bosses they have and all of the things that they're expected to do. But when we get underneath the surface of that, there still is this attitude, I want to do what I want to do when I want to do it, and I don't want to do that other stuff. So how do we discipline ourselves to do the things that we know have to be done? And, you know, kind of the starting point of all of that is, well, you know, really, what are my priorities?
Yeah.
Well, gosh, I don't know. Discipline to think about priorities. Why would I do that when I've got so many distractions and I can hang around people who are behaving badly and I'll feel better because I'm not behaving quite that badly, right? I can say to myself, well, I've got more discipline than that person.
That's justifying it. But, Mom,
really
it's only a little marijuana. Everybody else is doing it, so I guess it's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or I'm just smoking a weed and they're doing crack. So
yeah.
I'll be happy.
Sure, it's okay.
Really very funny.
But that's the justification.
Funny on the surface.
And that's what kills us.
Yeah. And when you look at, you know, we've said the political arena, when you start looking at the school systems, when you look at any organized, structured system,
yeah,
where we really do have to follow processes and rules and all of that, we've gotten so lazy.
Well,
Let
me hold you up on that. There, uh-huh. Let me beg to differ for the first time, okay? I actually watched the senator say, we got to do what we've got to do. I'm tired of the silly Constitution. Following the rules, there's no discipline. And I am not disagreeing with you. I'm absolutely agreeing with you. But
exactly.
If we had some of our politicians follow the rules, we wouldn't have the mess that we have.
Well, you know, the famous 14 that fled our state. That is, now they will say that was a disciplined choice. We needed to get the system off track because it was going to do something that we, you know, disagreed with. This is what elections are for.
Sure.
And so when the electorate follows the rules and chooses people that they want to have in office to do things that need to be done in a disciplined manner, if we are not going to agree to continue to follow the rules consistently and to have the discipline to deal with things we'd rather not. Right now we're talking about maturity, but it's all of the same piece. And
wait a minute, let me get up off the floor. You said the M word.
Yeah, maturity. I know. Sorry. Yeah. Maturity. No, but it goes along with discipline.
Yeah.
So, you know, we go back to, again, what are the priorities that we have individually as a country, as a nation, whatever. So it takes time to think about and really discipline to make the choices about what those are going to be. Critical thinking, we talked about a number of weeks ago on your program. We're not teaching it. We're not practicing it. Without critical thinking, there's very little chance we're going to have discipline. So if we can discipline ourselves to decide on what those priorities are, then allocate time for them, right? Here's the whole time management piece. There are so many other things we could be doing. And when we don't discipline ourselves to allocate time consciously, purposely to work on those priorities, we end up feeling bad. We end up feeling like we spent a whole lot of time and, gosh, I'm just not as far along as I should be, and then we think, well, maybe my priorities should be different, and here we go, the downward spiral. Fatigue, you know, self-loathing is strong, but self-disappointment sets in for that. So establish the priorities, allocate the time, say no to distractions. Boy, that takes discipline.
That's a tough one.
That's a tough one. And where are we teaching and practicing? You know, this is my mantra with you all the time. Who's teaching? How are we practicing? And I'm not just suggesting that by teaching and practicing this needs to be drudgery. Heavens no. We feel good when we learn things and when we can do things that, gosh, we never thought we could do. So important, we've got to look at the benefits and really the good people-building aspects of discipline. And saying no to distractions obviously is a big part of that. And of course, you know, bigger picture, it's really about aligning. It's doing what we say we want to do.
And don't go on vacation when the world is falling apart.
That's not discipline. You know what? It's mind-boggling.
Yeah.
It is simply mind-boggling. And actually, I was listening to Paul Ryan yesterday, also one of our Wisconsin's finest, who, by the way, is being excoriated for, you know, wanting to put grandma out in the street. But what he said that struck me as so profound, and they were just words, and they passed, and people got distracted with other things. But he said, we don't need politicians now. We need leaders.
Yeah.
And that means
we agree. We don't have any.
No. Well, we have few. And, you know, we're searching for more all the time.
Yeah, but the minute that they stand up, I mean, realistically, Susan, the minute that they stand up, they had an affair with this one. They lied about that. They barfed in public. I mean, it goes on and on and on. It's ridiculous.
Yes. Well, and I think the only way that's going to stop, or a way that's going to stop, is when people who can stand up and say, you know what, yes, I did. Well, Chris Abele in Milwaukee. I mean, the parking tickets and the not paying fines. And so he got elected handily. Now, that's a whole other thing. But when people can stand up and say, you know what, yes, I did that. I'm embarrassed about it. I'm ashamed of it. That was then. This is now. I have learned from it. Now, let's get back to the
example. I'll give you a prime example. Bill Clinton, when he said, I did not have sex with that woman. All he would have had to do was say, yes, I did. I understand that what I did was wrong, and I'll fix it.
Right. I'm a bonehead. I'm sorry. You know, I won't do it again. Of course, then that challenges
well, that's
the belief
too
of that,
far,
too.
Yeah.
But you're right. That's the point. We've all done stuff. We all have stories. Well, there are many stories, and this is my fear for the political system, is that really good, strong, intelligent people will not run because they don't want the skeletons rattling in the closet.
Sure.
Who would? Who would volunteer to say, you know what, strip me bare and, you know, show everybody my life?
Yeah.
But we've got to get to the point where we say, okay, you know what, strip me bare, show everybody my life. Okay, done? Good? Did you get a good look? Fine. Let's get back to the work that we need to do.
You know who
That's
I like? You know, I like Chris Christie.
I do, too. Oh, I do, too. And the whole hoopla about, you know, he's undisciplined, he's fat, he's whatever, and you know what? He just let him yammer. And then he said he's got work to do.
Yeah, stand by his word.
Right, right. So, yes, and so interesting to me that you brought him up in the context of discipline, because there is that argument, you know what, if he were disciplined, he'd lose weight, blah, blah. Who says? You know, so now we've got to be disciplined to check the assumptions we make when we make those kinds of statements about people we don't know. So I think that's another actually favorite aspect of mine about discipline is checking assumptions. You know, we make statements, and then if we were to stop ourselves and ask ourselves, wait a minute, why did I say that based on what information, what criteria am I using to measure this? That takes discipline.
Sure.
And you know what? It takes time, and it's hard work, and it's uncomfortable.
By the way, it's easy to learn. You know, and let me go this way with it. If people needed to learn how to make choices, make decisions. That's a very hard thing for people. So the way you do it is you get out of bed in the morning and you say, well, do I want to get on the left side or the right side of the bed? You walk over to the closet. Do I want to put this on or do I want to put that on? Am I going to put my right sock on first or my left sock on? Start small.
Well, and what I love about that example, Michael, is that we, in doing so and in helping people step through those everyday choices, we make the learning obvious.
Yeah, no question.
You are making decisions. You do have the capacity to make decisions. What different ones would you like to make? Where are you going? What would you like to do? How can we help you get there? You know, and there's the, I don't remember who said it way back when, before you and I were even, you know, twinkling in anybody's eyes, but in discipline, there's freedom. And if you think about that, if you make some decisions one time, it gives you a whole lot more time to make other decisions. I set the alarm, it goes off, I get up. I'm not remaking that decision every time I hit the snooze button. Now I've got all of that time that I'm trying to, you know, make that decision again and again to make other decisions, to write a book, to write my senators, to, you know, campaign for our next president, whatever. No, you won't find me doing that.
Sure. Well, that's going to be an interesting, you know what, between now and 2012, it's going to be a very interesting political time of more than a century, I think, of any time in history, what we're going to see. What we're going to see is discipline, non-discipline. What we're going to see is everything that you've talked about in the months and months and months that we have been interviewing and talking back and forth about the different aspects of backbone.
And I truly believe, and in addition to what you just said, that we are going to see the face of America as she is today. We are going to see America's soul, and I really pray that we've got enough disciplined people to make that look viable.
Yeah.
We've got some hard decisions to make in this country, and they're decisions that have been punted. You know, as Paul Ryan says, we've been kicking the can down the road. Well, yes, we have been. Who's going to finally stop? We've got a handful of people now who are saying this is not sustainable.
Yeah.
You know what? Stop. It's not going to be comfortable. It is going to require, you know, discipline and discomfort from a lot of people. So what?
But let me give you this underneath it. And I completely agree with there's got to be some sense of discipline with the entire thing. But I've watched it very closely, and I've watched politics for years and years and years and years, and I've watched people for so many years also, discipline, non-discipline, the attitudes, the behaviors, and what causes them to do what they do. And what I'm looking at truly is there is a tremendous amount of discipline in the political system today, but it's discipline based on what they want to accomplish. They know exactly what they're doing. Barack Obama is very smart. Anybody who says he's not an intellect and he's not smart, better take a second look at this guy, because everything he's done is absolutely intentional. He said it right before the election when he won the presidency. He said, I'm going to fundamentally change the United States of America. And he has done so. So if you really look at it, they are disciplined, but you've got to find out what the end goal is. What's the end result of what they're going to do? Then we can work backwards and say, okay, now this is discipline. This is what they wanted. And they've stayed on course. Even if they rip somebody apart, it's staying on course for the end result.
And that's, yes, And that is, you know, in the first part of our conversation this evening, that is that perversion of the word and the intent. You've got to look at the intent. You can't argue the discipline, and you're right. And he ran a campaign that was extraordinarily disciplined, that was well integrated, that took the energy of a lot of young people and really used it to serve his purpose. That, you know, I mean, it's impressive. However,
absolutely it is.
It is an abrogation of what this country is all about and has been
and that
about
too,
since
yes.
founding. And that's
you
where
know,
we
can talk all night. We're starting to run out of time. And let me ask you this, the most important question of the night, website
yes,
we can
sir.
Find you at.
www.executiveadvisorllc.com.
Wonderful. Susan Marshall, can we get the book there?
Absolutely. It is right on the front homepage. Click on the book. 800 CEO Read will provide it for you.
Wonderful. Hey, see you next week.
Thank you, Michael Ray. You take care.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do, say don't cry.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray Dresser. You are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do, say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own, hallelujah. I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
And double welcome back. You are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. If you want to join in, pick up a phone call, 530-413-4511 or 530-413-4515. Paul and Barbara Gerhard is with us. They are the co-authors of the brand new book called Choice Matters, and they tackle the tough questions Americans must face and must have the civil discourse of the country's most pressuring issues. They also outline pragmatic, workable solutions to some of the vexing problems facing society today. And let us say, Paul and Barbara, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Thank you, guys. Let's see, you're in Chicago, right?
No. We came from Chicago, but we live
came
in Florida.
From Chicago. Oh, Florida. All right. I was going to say, if you're in Chicago, you guys could yell. I could probably hear you. We're right out of the Milwaukee area.
I thought you recognized an old Chicago accent because we lived there 40 years ago.
Oh, that's what it was. I was born in Chicago 100 years ago. I was brought up in Los Angeles, and I remember when I was a kid, they all used to make fun of me when I was in junior high school, and because I'd say "mien," wouldn't say "man," say "mien." Then I finally lost the accent. Now I'm in Wisconsin, and I'm starting to get it back again.
Oh, that's funny. Well, we thought Midwest accent was just perfect.
Now, by the way, let's talk about Choice Matters. When we talk about choice, how many people know, based on whatever subject there is, and Paul, let's throw this to you, how many people know that they do have choice in the different areas of their life, whether it be politically, economically, socially, culturally, whatever? Most people walk in thinking that they're limited in that their ability to be able to choose, and that's not so, is it?
No, it's not, although in some cases people are limited in their ability to choose. Sometimes they have, you know, choices presented to them which are not complete. For instance, without getting into politics, so you remember in going into Iraq, where our president said we either fight them over there or we fight them over here. Well, that was a choice we had, but it was kind of a false choice because there were others. You know, so choices exist, and our book came about because we just kept seeing more and more areas where we faced choices, and sometimes we couldn't do anything about it, or sometimes we felt that we should all discuss these things and come up with some possible solutions. Just like the fellow we had on speaking about Social Security funding, frustrating things like that, part of our book. It goes on and on.
And by the way, when we take a look at it, I think that's where the problem is. It's what do I do about whatever the case may be? And if you don't have the choice, you don't have the choice because you don't understand what the issue is and the different dimensions of the issue, like health care reform, you know, choices. We walked in thinking there's no choice. Now, all of a sudden, we're looking at it a little bit different. Barbara, let's throw that one at you with health care. What kind of health care reform do we really need, and how do you make it work on a practical level?
Well, that was kind of Paul's question, but I can talk about it a little bit. We feel that we need Medicare for everyone. We feel that there are a lot of middle-aged people who just cannot afford health care. Our daughter, for one, is a person who is self-employed, has a hard time making it, and her health care is not good. If she were to become ill, she could lose everything. The several little houses she's trying to pay off to retire at some point in time, it would all be gone. And I think it's terrible that when people are responsible people, that they could completely lose all of their savings to a health issue. And I think we need to cover some basic health care for everyone. Of course, there's got to be oversight in this issue, or you're going to have, and you have right now, you have people cheating. You have doctors cheating. I don't know. How do we stop this cheating? That's a good question.
I think the biggest problem that we have with healthcare today, what they're calling healthcare, is not healthcare. I completely adhere to exactly what you're saying. There's got to be some form of healthcare that if somebody does get into trouble, if they happen to own property, they're not going to lose everything that they have because of the sickness. I mean, that in and of itself, quote unquote, is not the American way. So there's got to be something that is a workable program that everybody can get into. The problem that the doctors are having right now and the problem that private businesses are having right now is they can't afford it. They're having to let people go. The doctors are having to cut down on staff because they can't afford those ongoing and continuous expenses if they are forced to charge certain amounts of money just so they can live. That eliminates anybody going in to see them.
Yeah, I think that if you're going to have a system, you have to pay decently. And that's one of the problems with perhaps discipline comes up again, just like your last speaker was saying.
Sure.
That you have to discipline yourself and realize that if you're going to have benefits, they have to be paid for. And if individuals can't pay for them, then you're probably going to have to do it through taxes.
By the way, there is no question, and I believe very strongly, and I don't want to get off into this issue, but we should have a pay-as-you-go system. That levels the playing field for everybody. Go down and buy a loaf of bread, and you got your taxes right included in the bread. It's done. It's over with. You don't have to play with it. But that said, one of the biggest problems that we have are we've gotten into, quote-unquote, a welfare state. We've gotten to a point when we've listened to the politicians. They've said, this is what you get if you vote for me. And there's where the problem is. The independence, the free market economy that we were so proud of seems to be whittling away. And where do you go with all of this?
Well, I guess in our book we have a chapter on that regarding statesmen versus politicians. And I guess if we could elect statesmen, it would take care of that. But that's kind of hard to do.
Sure.
Yeah, there's a money factor that comes into it, and it's very hard for most people to run for office and stay independent. And
well, by the way, there's something called consensus, and I think that's where the problem that most of them have going in. You know, for years, I spent 23 years in Fairbanks, Alaska, in the interior. And I remember being on the radio there, and the local politicians would come in. Somebody would come in, and they were running for office, and they had a particular personality and a particular style, and they would get elected in the office. The war cry was, you know, I want to see things change. I'm mad. I don't like what's going on. So they get into office. They don't realize that individually they can't do anything about it themselves. It takes that consensus. Then they start to get into the program. And as they do, it's almost like, Paul, it's like euphoria. It's almost like a drug. Mm-hmm. And then the next thing you know, they're part of that system, and they're not who they were. I watch personalities change, Barbara.
A perfect example of that would be about 10 years or so ago, maybe 14 years ago, when a large number of representatives came in vowing they would only serve two terms and leave. And about 90% of them stayed on. So they become part of the system. You're right.
It's like a drug. And
we elected a president that we felt very strongly was going to make some changes, and he seems to have gotten kind of sucked into the whole thing, too.
He made changes coming out of him.
Pardon?
He made some changes, all right. But let's talk about something else that you approach, and it's the illegal immigration. And I think there in and of itself is a problem. We spend hundreds of billions of dollars a year for people who come in and use the goods, the services, go to the universities, do all the things that they do, whereby if you're a citizen, if you can't pay for it, you don't get it.
That's right. And that's part of our health problem, too, because we have illegal immigrants that we do take care of in the emergency rooms of this country. I think that if we had clinics and we made everyone pay a co-payment when they went into the clinic, and they could get decent medical care, not maybe specialists, but at least they would get whatever they needed for their sore throat and their without going into the emergency room and costing us a lot.
You know, right now we have about 40 million undereducated workers in our country. That's by today's modern standards. When I graduated from high school, a person, if they didn't go on to college as I did, my friends could get a job in manufacturing or construction and provide a good life for themselves and their family. But that has changed. Jobs, manufacturing jobs, have disappeared due to technological advances and a global outsourcing situation. And then you have these illegal folks coming in and taking a lot of those jobs.
No, by the way, what happened with the outsourcing was a very interesting thing. We had the mom and pops years ago, which were wonderful. You walked into the stores, the banks, they knew who you were. They patted you on the back. They asked how your mom was, your dad was, your aunt, uncle, brother, sister, whatever. And then the major corporations came in, and the mom and pops couldn't compete with the corporations. Corporations stayed strong for a while, and then we went global. When we went global, it was the same thing. They couldn't afford to compete, so they outsourced. When they outsourced, people went home on their computers and went into businesses for themselves and recreated the mom and pop. So we've gone full circle on that.
Yes, to an extent we have, although a lot of the undereducated type of jobs have been taken over by people who are here illegally. And you have to recognize the illegals who are here, they're poor, they work hard for less money, et cetera. But, the whole world is like that, and we just can't bring them in here and take those jobs away from our people who need them.
You know, one of the things that I've seen that's really hit is the church and state, religion and the government. We talk about keep it separate. It would be wonderful if we could do that if we didn't choose what religions to say either you can be talked about, you can't be talked about, and so on and so forth. I saw something happen with the culture, and it was with Christianity and all of the things that were taken out of the schools. You know, during Christmas time, when you can't have the manger and you can't have pictures of Jesus and so on and so forth. Now, I happen to be Jewish, and I was brought up with singing Christmas carols, Christmas trees, and all the things that were part of my country and part of my culture. And I really object to see those things being taken out of the schools. But at the same time, if you're going to do that with one, you got to do it with everybody, and they're not doing it.
That's absolutely true. You have folks who will support, for instance, prayer in school, and that's fine as long as it's their type of prayer. But if it's someone else's prayer, then it's a little different story. So in that case, I think
we feel that there has to be a definite separation between religion and education, religion
but
and
then
politics.
Make, yeah, but then and make it, Barbara, then make it all of it.
Yeah. But we've asked a question in our book, you know, would you want to send our Christian, pay for our Christian granddaughter's education? You shouldn't have to. If they want to go send their children to a private school, they should pay for it. And the first thing that our new governor came in, he's trying to get vouchers in, and we don't think that's a good idea.
Okay, but the point of contention is if you're going to separate church and state, separate all the churches, not just a particular sect or whatever. And
I
think, what the key is. And also, if you're going to say pledge allegiance to the flag, there's nothing wrong with that. We're pledging allegiance to a country that has given us everything we could possibly get. They allow you and I to talk and say what we want on the air.
Yeah.
It's a country that if Barbara, if Paul gets mad at you, you know he's not going to cut your head off. I mean, I don't know how other
you
say it.
You must have read our book.
You know what, guys? I'm an American, and I will always be an American. And I say this in jest, but I'm serious. If you were to ask me who I would want for president and vice president, John Wayne and the Fonz. That's where I'm at. I'm old school.
Yes, indeed.
But that's the key.
Almost rather have someone who is very ethical and not any religion. Someone, a moral, ethical person of no religion, be our president. If that would treat everyone more fairly.
Yeah. No, and I completely agree. And if somebody is going to be, but isn't that the base of all religions, for the most part, be ethical, be fair, be et cetera? I can't imagine. Well, yes, I can. I just take that. the guy with that burned the Quran about a week or so.
Oh, golly.
And in addition to that.
But, you could take and burn 10 Bibles, and we would just say, I'll go buy another one. There's a little bit of difference.
That's the point. This guy's responsible for murder.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Oh,
he
definitely.
Is, because he knew that Muslims would react like that. He knew that. That's how they react. They take their Quran very, very personally.
Yeah, no question about it. And I really believe when you come down to it, what he was doing with the military and the burials. I mean, that is a shame. It should never happen.
Well, that was a different fellow.
That was another fellow.
That was terrible.
That
was another wing nut that was out there.
Right. Well, no, you know what? I thought it was the same guy. All right, it's not.
No, there's another one.
That other one was from Oklahoma somewhere. I think it was Oklahoma.
Yeah, you mean there's more than one of them were in trouble?
There's more than one, Michael Ray.
Yeah, but we have freedom of speech. But when freedom of speech crosses the line, it's when you remember the old "you can't yell fire in a movie theater." If you incite a riot, if you cause harm, then freedom of speech has crossed the line. If those people would have died here in the United States, then I'm quite confident he could have gotten nailed.
Yep. The freedom of speech, you can wave, waving your arms around, but that right stops when it comes in the range of my nose.
Yeah. No, and it got loud and clear. Now, one of the things that you do talk about, which I think is interesting, is the legalization of marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
Let me give you a quick comment about that, and then we'll move with it. Let me tell you what I think about drugs. I think that all drugs should be 100% legal. Now, let me finish it. They become completely legal. You want cocaine, you want acid, you want whatever it is that they do. All of it should be totally legal. Now, there should be a compound in every city. And if you want to go do drugs, you want to go wipe yourself.
You didn't read our book yet, but it's in there.
Okay, good. Stay there and do what you're going to do to each other until it's over with. It would stop all of the drug sales, and it would stop
all of it. That's right. That is our idea for getting
rid of it. The only thing we added to it was they could have field trips from the schools to see how these poor people live with their drugs.
One of the things we have to do is we have to educate people to make the right choices. And you have to start that education very early. And taking young people to see what actually happens when someone decides to use drugs that can be addictive to them. Take away a lot of the charm of using those drugs.
All right, let me give you my feeling about how things should be run. We're going to make me king of America, okay? I'm king of America. You can't say no to me. That's that. What I would do, the first thing I would do is I would take every citizen and bring them back in from every country that they're in. I'd bring them back in so we're all here in the country. Then I would put up a 20-foot fence around the entire country. You couldn't come in and you couldn't go out. And then I would start at the edge and I would start working my way towards the middle and I would clean up the streets. I would clean up the crime. I would clean up the gangs. I would do all of those things. And once we had it together and we were living in a country that you could drive down the street and if you had a flat tire, somebody could stop and help you and you wouldn't have to worry that somebody was going to hurt you. You could walk down any given street in any rural community and not be hurt. Or any community that was right in the middle of a major city. And once we got that together, I'd tear the fences down. And then I'd start to move back out again.
Mm-hmm. We like to vote for you.
It's here.
Yeah. You know, back in 86 when we gave amnesty to 3 million illegals, at that point in time, we were supposed to ban our borders and not let any more in. We figure out in the last 25 years that one illegal has crossed our border every minute of every day of every week.
Yeah, but Barbara, what that really was, and we're starting to run out of time now, but what that really was had nothing to do with opening up the border and allowing 3 million illegals to come in. What that had to do, that was a political ploy to get the Hispanic vote, period, end. That's all that was.
Yeah.
But it gave naturalization to 3 million that were already here. But it also encouraged the next 12 or 15 million to come in because they figure we'll do the same thing again, and we will.
Now, let me ask you this. We're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, we do, www.gerhartbooks.com.
Wonderful. By the way, I want to thank you both so much for joining us. I've appreciated all the time that you spent with us, and can we buy the book on the website?
Yes, you can. It's also available at Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble.
And our other
books. And we have an e-book, too. And it's in the e-book form.
Wonderful. By the way, Paul and Barbara, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you so much for inviting us.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
And follow your star, brave and faithful and true, and cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you, and I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do, say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do, say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I've had a love of my own, hallelujah. I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Sandra Wright with us. Sandra Wright is the author of 40 Plus and Fabulous Moving Forward. Fierce, focused, and full of life. She's president of J.W. Wright & Associates, Limited, a commercial landscape construction firm. She founded it in 1997 with her husband, John. 15 years experience as a small business owner managing construction projects, negotiating contracts, providing contract administration, and acting as a liaison between client, project staff, city departments, and utilities or other contractors. And let us say, Sandra, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Excited to be with you.
Oh, and thank you. 40 plus and fabulous, moving forward, fierce, focused, and full of life. Life doesn't stop at 40 now, does it?
Life absolutely starts at 40. And there's a quote by a psychotherapist that life begins at 40. Up until then, we're just doing the research.
You know, realistically, that's true, because think about it. You really don't get it together till you're just about 40. You know, you've fallen down, you got back up again, you've done most of the things that made most of your mistakes, and now you kind of got a handle on what's forward, and you move and you maneuver. You can still make mistakes, but they're not going to be as crashing and deadly as the ones before 40.
You're absolutely right. That's when it begins to start making sense for us. And the mistakes, of course, we're going to still make them, but they're not quite as devastating because we've survived and we've overcome so many things from our past. And now we have that wisdom and that understanding to know that, you know, it doesn't end. You know, those little hurdles and those little obstacles that come our way, we're going to survive them because we've done so in the past.
You know, it's interesting because you've gotten your BA in psychology, your MS in counseling and human resources, and the key there is you've been trained in human behavior, and when it really comes down to it, it's all of those things as a kid. Even if you were to get a manual to say this is how you live your life and this is what you're going to do, you still have to fall down, don't you?
You absolutely have to fall down. There's no way around it. You can't circumvent it, and you have to go through those valley experiences to really reach the mountaintop. And I know it sounds cliche, but there's absolutely no way that you can enjoy a fulfilling life without having those little bumps, in the road along the way. It's all a part of our perfecting, our becoming, our best self.
Oh, and the bumps are the ones that makes you appreciate absolutely what you have. And there's a maturity. You know, we can go back 30, 40, 50 years, 60 years, whatever the case may be. And 40 years old, people were, they were up there. I remember when my mom, way back when, 100 years ago, my mom was saying, I remember her 50th birthday. And this was, she was an old lady in her head at that stage of the game. That's not so today. We've changed. We've grown from then.
We've changed and we've grown, but I want to, you know, one of the things that we have to know is women have been definitely sold a bill of goods as it relates to this whole aging thing, that 40 is over the hill and it's all downhill after that. And the media has done a wonderful job, and they've had a darn good laugh at our expense for a long time, just kind of portraying us as the menopausal, lonely, empty nesters. And heaven forbid, Michael, you're still single over 40, because word on the street is you've got a better chance of getting struck by lightning twice than you do of getting married over 40. So the jokes and the puns and everything, yes, they're intended to be funny. But when we internalize those things, that's where the harm comes.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the most important word that you just said with all of it is internalizing it, not letting it out, not letting people know. And then it affects everybody around you and how your life turns out. 40 is okay. And when I say 40 is okay, most people won't get that until they've experienced what you just talked about, that it's okay to be 40 and you're still full of life and full of activity and full of all the feelings and then some of anybody who's 20 years old.
You're right, and that's my message. That's what I want women to know, the truth, you know, about how powerful and how valuable we are at this stage of life, and that's where I come to the rescue with 40 Plus and Fabulous.
Oh, sure, and by the way, women have gone through transitions, I think, you know, especially during, I think it's the Second World War that it started to happen. But before that, women really didn't have there was no equal playing field. Women were women and they had their places and that was the end of it. During World War II, when the men went to war, quote unquote, the women started taking over the men's jobs. And all of a sudden they became a valuable asset in the workforce. Then came the 50s. Women changed a little bit in the 50s because at that stage of the game, they wanted to protect their kids. They lost a lot of kids during the war, and now all of a sudden it was, I want to be mom and I want to protect. 60s came along. Then there was the peace movement and the marches. Women began to transition, and as the years went by, that playing field got more and more leveled all the time. And I think that's really, if we look back through history, that's what we looked at the time. And today, a woman at 40 years old has the same opportunity, and I'm going to say the opportunity as a man. We are not all built equal. You know, some are bigger, some are smaller. I would venture to guess that you're not going to go out and try to get a job as a, you know, a fullback on a professional football team. It's not going to work. But what we do have in this world, in this country that we live in, is the one thing they can't take away from us is the freedom of opportunity. You have the opportunity to go apply, then it's up to you to get it.
We have the same opportunity, but we still don't get the same pay. And when we take that historical look back, we have to remember that women didn't even get the right to vote until 1920. For all of history, we've been seen a little as less than, you know. And so even when it comes to the aging thing, there's always somebody out there who wants to make us feel less than. And so we've got to make sure that we control our own power, and we never allow anyone to take anything from us.
No, absolutely. You know what? Let's take a little bit of a sidestep on that one. I really believe what's happened is not necessarily it's been taken away. What you, is in the general sense of the word, you as women have been taught to give it away. And I think that's where the transition is. Don't give it away anymore because it's yours.
That's right. You're right. Yeah. You're right. And you're absolutely right. Don't give it away, ladies. It belongs to you. No one has the right to make you feel bad about it. And no one can take from you what you don't give to them.
Yeah. And what you're talking about, too, which is very interesting, the revelations, how men really feel about women over 40. And let me tell you what I feel about women who are 40 years old. You ready for this?
I am ready.
I hope you're sitting down.
I am.
They're too young for me. men feeling about women over 40. What is that? What are those things that we don't think about?
You know, and this was a real treat for me, because one of the most painful stereotypes that I think we see played out in the media as it relates to women and aging is the 40-plus woman whose mate has left her for a younger woman. And we all know it happens. We see it every day. But I began to get the most incredible feedback from men who are more evolved and more emotionally mature, who are completely attracted to over 40 women, her physical self, her mental and emotional self. And they love that confidence that she has now, that sense of self, the fact that she knows what she wants and she's not afraid to articulate that. She's found her voice. And men find that very attractive and very appealing. And that's why I couldn't wait to put a section in this book that I call Straight Talk and Men's Thoughts About 40-plus and Fabulous Women, because we always see the other side of that, but we never see or hear from or very rarely see or hear from the men like you who say, I like my women a little more seasoned.
Yeah, absolutely, because when it really comes down to it, why go through the process of some, and let's face it, younger women, 20, 35, up to 40 years old or so, they're still learning. They're still going through the breakups and the new relationships and all the mistakes that they'll never make again, and they find something different, and then they fall down again. I mean, it happens with men also. It's nice to have a little maturity of someone who's seen a few things and is able to choose what she wants.
Yes.
Wasn't me that said that. That was the, I have this, for some reason, there's a sound on my computer that I got in credit mail. And there's this little butler that comes out and says, sir, you have mail. And then if I don't check the mail, it goes, and I can't turn it off. So if you hear noises, it's not me.
Okay. I can't hear what I'm saying.
What inspired you to write the book? What was it that triggered you in the first place?
You know, I got the idea to write a book, and it was really supposed to be just a 20-page ebook. And, you know, I was just trying to figure out, you know, who am I and what is it that I would have to give to women in a book. And I was during my sleep that it came to me, Sandra, you are 40-plus and fabulous. And I'm a spiritual person, so I really believe that was my God placing that seed in me. But when I heard that, it just all came pouring back to me. It made sense. The number of women that I had been in front of who are just still so full of dreams and so full of goals and so full of aspirations, but somewhere along their journey, they've internalized these messages from society that their value is decreasing after 40. And so they feel stuck. They feel afraid to go forward for those things that they still want because they see age as a barrier. And that's just unacceptable for me, that a woman would be hurting or feel with anxiety or fear because she's doing what she's supposed to do naturally in the first place, which is age. So I just wanted to give women a gift, something that was going to set them free from those limiting mindsets and something that could show them images of real-life, everyday women doing the things that they say that they're afraid to do in their 40s, their 50s, their 60s, their 70s. There's images of women at every decade of life reinventing and just living incredible lives doing the things that they love regardless of age and regardless of the things that they've had to overcome. That was my inspiration for putting something like this out there.
And by the way, it's a message that in today's world, maybe not 20, 30 years ago, that it couldn't have happened because of the culture and society and the mindsets. But in today's world, it's the window of opportunity for the message is there because there's so much truth in it at this stage of the game. It started out with feminism, and let me give you my definition of feminism. If feminism is the equality of opportunity, I'm a feminist. But if feminism is the subjugation of man, to get your point across, then I'm on the other side of the table. And I really believe that it went through that transition. You don't have to put somebody down to show them how good you are. There is a strength that's coming out in the quote-unquote new woman today that it's there. The women are becoming executives. Women are becoming the business owners and all of those things that they didn't think they could do before. Well, it's there and it's available. All you have to do is take the first step. But if you don't take the step, Sandra, it's not going to happen for you.
It's your responsibility. You're absolutely right to reach for it and to go for it. And you're so right because I absolutely do not believe in nail bashing to get my point across. It's not necessary. But you absolutely hit the nail on the head that everything out there is yours for the taking. Just reach out and take your piece of it. And it doesn't end until you make the decision, the choice to end it, regardless of age. At whatever age you decide to cut it off, it cuts off.
See, and that's got to be the underlying force of America today. I mean, this is what we have been about for quite a while now. And, you know, we're in a position now that we have to keep what we've had. You know, there are countries now that women are still property. I mean, there's no question about that. You step out of line, you're going to get your head cut off. That's not what we want. That's not who we are. So it's called take advantage of everything that you have here because it's yours for the taking.
That's right. That is absolutely right.
Yeah, and it's a wonderful place to live in, and I really believe that we're going to see a lot of the things that you're saying. And also, too, if there are women out there that don't get it, if they pick up the book and they read the book, that little aha moment that says, oh, well, maybe I can be like that, that's the turning point. It's just that millisecond of recognition of a way to fix things that causes that first step.
And seeing that those opportunities that you were just talking about get richer with age, because you have so much more that you're able to bring to the table now.
And that's an interesting point. You do have more that you can bring to the table. There was a time that you couldn't bring it. You might have had it inside of you, but if you didn't have the opportunity to not necessarily express it, but to realize it in some way, then you couldn't talk about it because it wasn't part of what you owned. Now you can go out and own it. It's part of you, and you can talk about it and be respected for what it is that you're talking about. And that comes from a right-to-the-center Republican. How's that?
How about that?
Not radical. Okay. Now, by the way, let me ask you this. Website we can find you at.
The website is www.40plusandfabulous.com. You can either spell it all out or use the number 40, P-L-U-S-A-N-D, FABULOUS.com.
Wonderful. Hey, thank you, Sandra, so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael.
Take care.
Have
good night.
Making a crazy ding-dong.
And if this band don't desert us,
then there's nothing in the world can hurt us. Long as we're singing our song.
Give me trumpets, legato.
Put some saxes with them.
Strings, pizzicato.
Add some rhythm. As long as we're singing, then the world's all right and everything's swinging. Long as we're singing out. Long as we're singing out. Long as we're singing.
Hey, thanks for listening. And if you're listening on the web, tell your local radio station about the show. That's the way we grow. And that's what you call networking. I'm Michael Ray Dresser. And that, my friends, is a wrap.